You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Good evening, Shane. This is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland.
And this is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico. And this is episode number 11 of The Atomic Show.
And there, yes, is a moment of silence as Rod adjusts some things on his machine. And anyway, there's been quite a bit of developments in the nuclear world in the last week or so, and many of them are more political than they are technological, which is not surprising in the nuclear world.
Political? Nuclear? Come on.
Yes, well, apparently there has been a study by the Government Accountability Office, and that study has been touted by some folks that don't like nuclear power as saying that the nuclear industry has simply not done enough to protect itself against the possibility of terrorist attacks. And I'm shaking in my boots.
Indeed.
Yeah. So anyway.
So what's the premise of the report?
Well, the premise of the report is that the nuclear industry went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and strong-armed them into changing their mind as to what they should consider as the appropriate threat that the nuclear power plant should protect themselves against. Now, let's give a little background here.
Yeah.
We've got in the U.S. about 103 nuclear power plants on 65 sites. And that set of industrial facilities has a guard force that has increased from 5,000 people up to 8,000 people.
And that's 800 people per plant, or 80 people per plant.
Right. Per reactor.
Per reactor, I should say.
But remember, there's only 65 sites.
Right.
So there's probably
8,000 divided by 65, that's nominally 100 people per site.
Right. And, you know, assuming these guys do shift work and stuff, there's probably at least, you know, I don't know, 25, 30 people on duty at any one time at an industrial facility. And I've been through the security process. Let me tell you, these guys are armed to the teeth, former military for the most part, or have lots of security or police force experience. And
not
also,
mall cops.
Say again?
Not mall cops.
Definitely not. There's an interesting video available from YouTube and Google Video that has a description of what kind of training the guard forces go through. It's pretty impressive. But, you know, notwithstanding the training, the other part of this is that nuclear power plants are not particularly easy targets to even find, much less hit. Of course, I guess it's not really hard to find the power plant because usually there's some fairly significant cooling water stacks nearby. But finding a
vulnerable... From personal experience, you can see the cooling plume from something on the order of 20 miles sometimes.
Well, that's true. Of course, not all plants have cooling towers, but quite a few do. And, of course, it'd be easy to mistake and think you're going towards a nuclear plant if you're just aiming for a cooling tower.
And find yourself attacking a lonely, normal, run-of-the-mill coal plant instead, which has exactly the same shape of cooling tower that has engendered such paranoia and outright freaking out that people have been seeing for 20 or 30 years.
You know, I think that sometimes there's a little bit of a psychological thing, because the cooling tower, for the optimal shape to produce good cooling flow, happens to be a mushroom-shaped structure.
Well, you're just imposing a concrete boundary condition about what nature wants to impose anyway.
Right.
When you have a large flow of hot air.
Right. So it looks a little like the mushroom cloud that results when you have any large explosion. So anyway, there's been I always thought there was a little bit of a linking in people's minds and their visualization of what things look like.
I've asked people about that when I get them to try to describe to me what they fear, or if they even have any necessarily negative images of the people who are kind of on the fence. And the cooling towers are usually one of the things that they associate. And they're not exactly uncommon structures. As a matter of fact, there was a thing on the History Channel and cable where they were talking about engineering disasters. It's a series called Engineering Disasters, and they spent some time on one episode where they actually went into how one of those cooling towers failed during construction and injured and killed quite a few construction workers, and that was in West Virginia. They're not small structures, and they're not easy to build, and they're useful for any plant that has to dispose of a large amount of heat into the air without thermally polluting a waterway.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that if you dig back into the history of the concern over thermal pollution and applying that history to the nuclear industry and the anti-nuclear activists, a little bit of an interesting story, because the first concerns about thermal pollution occurred for power plants that were located on rivers in Europe. And in some places, particularly in areas in the Rhineland in Germany, the number of industrial facilities and the number of power plants that were located on the same river yielded some very hot water, some water that was 30 to 40 degrees above ambient temperatures during certain parts of the year, and certainly produced some unhealthy conditions for fish and other things.
So the question is, how do we get from regulations that were put in to deal with obviously bad situations like that, 30 to 40 degrees above ambient, to situations where now the regulation has tightened in on an optimum that can never be reached just because of thermodynamics, of no change between the upstream and downstream portions of the cooling water. Now it's, I believe at the last time that I looked, the boundaries within which they would allow excessive temperatures were down in the single degrees, if not below.
Yes. Well, the first plant in the U.S. that was actually taken to task for contributing to thermal pollution and took a while to get its environmental impact statement approved was the Calvert Cliffs plant, one of the plants that's near and dear to my heart because it's located only about 40 or 50 miles south of my home in Annapolis. And that plant is not even on a river. It's on a very large estuary called the Chesapeake Bay. And the amount of temperature rise that plant produced is quite low. And interestingly enough, one of my volunteer work that I do on occasion is my wife and I help out with a fishing tournament that occurs once a year. And almost invariably, the winner of the fishing tournament catches their fish near the power plant.
I've heard of that phenomenon multiple times. At the Grand Gulf plant in Mississippi, I've heard of several retired engineers who absolutely adored going out to the cooling outstream. I believe one of the plant may have an outlet to a local water supply, which is a Oxbow Lake, since it's very close to the Mississippi River. And there's some extremely good fishing to be had there. And they don't tell anybody except for just a few people, and it managed to reach my ears eventually. So I don't think that's an isolated phenomenon. Fish are cold-blooded.
Yes, well, apparently crocodiles are often also cold-blooded. That's true.
That could potentially be bad.
Well, the reason I say crocodiles is because one of the largest concentrations of crocodiles in the U.S. is in the cooling water canals near the Turkey Point power plant in Homestead, Florida.
That's in Dade County. That's, as I recall, the range of crocodiles in America is restricted to just extreme South Florida.
Which is true. Which is one of the reasons why Turkey Point has so many crocodiles in it. But the population has increased considerably since they provided the nice meandering water for the cooling canals there.
Right. So I think we've gotten, as we tend to do, a little off topic.
Yes. Anyway, going back to this security thing, it's obvious to me that there are people that are making a big deal about the report because their goal in life is to continue to add costs to the nuclear industry to the point where they will try to make it uneconomic. And I even came across an entry in the notes or the comments section of the NEI Nuclear Notes blog, and the commenter was Mr. Paul Gunter, who has been an anti-nuclear activist with the Nuclear Information and Research Service, NIRS, for a number of years. And here's what Mr. Gunter said. This is another clear example of why we need to abandon nuclear power. The industry is unwilling to bear the full cost of upgrading security around target-rich nuclear power stations. Industry and its federal promoters should not be allowed to build new nuclear power stations in light of the unreasonable costs of guarding nuclear power from catastrophe. Distributed renewable energy generation is how we should harden our national energy policy. Now, the NIRS tends to try to claim that it is not anti-nuclear, that it is merely trying to make nuclear power safer, and that its information is just aimed at providing decision-making information to people so that they can make better decisions about how to operate and harden nuclear facilities. But it's pretty obvious that in this particular case, Mr. Gunter has made it clear that what he really wants is to stop nuclear power, regardless of the benefits that it might have for things like clean air, clean water, and lower cost, reliable electricity.
One or two drowning victims, as bad as they would be, are being used to justify outlawing the drinking of water.
Yes, it's not a good thing.
No. And considering exactly what is involved in building a nuclear power plant, they're not exactly facilities that you can walk up to and barge into. And they are built, they are easily the most resilient structures that human beings have ever built by orders of magnitude.
Yes,
when you're dealing with something that has walls on the order of a yard, a meter for our metric friends, a meter thick with rebar in it on the order of 4 or 5 inches thick, such that you have to vibrate the concrete when you're pouring it in order to get to flow between the rebar because the rebar is so densely concentrated through the entire containment.
Yes, they are very resilient structures. And I think, and I've heard of it before, and I think you mentioned it while we were talking just before the show started. There have been some experiments to see what would happen if you aimed an aircraft directly at the kind of structure that would be similar to the way that a containment vessel is structured. And what happens there, Shane?
The result, as one of the engineers on the test put it, is pretty damn small pieces. The test in question was done at Sandia National Labs about 20 some odd years ago and is actually available as a video from their public access portion of their website. Go to sandia.gov and search on video. You'll be able to find this test where they put an F4 on a rocket sled and ran it at many hundreds of miles per hour into a simulated section of containment wall. And other than leaving a black stain on the wall and pitting the wall a little bit, maybe a few inches deep out of a full total distance, the containment section that they used was a little thicker than usual, it was 12 feet. But the experiment was scaled to provide data on that question, and the answer is pretty obvious, nothing.
I've had some people that have tried to throw questions on that particular video in the study, and one of the things that they don't seem to understand is that, yes, there are larger aircraft in the world than an F-4, but an F-4 is pretty dense aircraft, and it was going very fast compared to the speeds that commercial aircraft go.
The F-4 was the densest fighter aircraft that the United States has ever fielded for the military. And the only denser aircraft I know of was a MiG-25, which is a Russian airplane, which is still flying today, and which is built like an iron. And it's built with steel. And very, very, very few aircraft are built with steel. And even though the F-4 doesn't have near as much steel in it, it still has some, to my knowledge. It's a very dense airplane. And it's pretty much like throwing a big lead slug with wings at the target. By comparison, a passenger airplane is more like an aluminum foil paper airplane. It's very light, very, 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 very light for its size. A 747 has a wingspan of well over a football field, only weighs 300 tons fully fueled on takeoff. Empty, it weighs less than 100 tons. For something that big and weighs that little, the only things on a 747 which could potentially do damage would be the engines. And I have seen numerous numerical studies where they assumed, okay, what would happen if you ran the 747 into a containment? And assumed that you managed to hit the containment dead on with one of the engines, because, well, the engine spacing is such that you could probably only hit the containment with one engine. The result is about the same as it would be for the F-4 test. A black stain, some casualties on site, some destruction of buildings besides the containment, but both the containment and also dry storage of spent fuel on site, those containers are built to the same standards, if not higher standards, because they're eventually meant to be transported than a containment, which kind of puts the lie to the whole mobile Chernobyl buzzword they've been floating.
Yeah, but it sounds so scary. I mean, you can't take away a good buzzword from the anti-news, can you?
Dihydrogen monoxide kills hundreds of people a year. If you inhale it, it will kill you.
That's right. There's enough dihydrogen monoxide in a little bathtub to kill, I don't know how many, anyway. I don't know.
If you divide it finally, dihydrogen monoxide for our less chemically oriented people in the audience would be ordinary water. And believe it or not, dihydrogen monoxide, the term was actually used on a government official not too long ago, and they bought it. And they proceeded to go full tilt into trying to figure out what needed to be done about this threat until they were finally notified, sir, it's water.
Yeah, it's probably a nice practical joke from an engineer.
Makes you feel good about our elected representative science literacy.
Well, they are elected representatives, after all.
This is true.
There's no qualifications to get there. Just a matter of who votes for it. You know, sometimes, and please, folks, don't get me wrong, I love living in a democracy. But there are times when I remember back to one of my father's favorite Peanuts cartoons. And it was, I can't remember exactly what Lucy and her friends were trying to do, but it was completely illogical. But her answer was, well, let's vote on it and decide if we can do it or not. And, you know, I think it was something about trying to cross a river without getting wet or some nonsense. And her solution was, if we voted and a majority said we can do it, then we would be able to do it. Some things just aren't subject to a vote.
Like physical reality, for instance.
Yeah. Well,
so having disposed of the physical characteristics of a plant that make it kind of difficult to assault with a, say, turning an airplane, a large airplane, into a missile, as was so unfortunately demonstrated just a few years ago.
Let me interrupt for a second. I want to remind folks that what was the damaging part about the impacts of the 9/11 airplanes was not their ability to try to knock something down or penetrate or anything like that.
It's the fact that they were mostly fuel.
That's right. They were purposely selected to be cross-country aircraft that had just taken off, so they were fully loaded with fuel. And that fuel is what caused the inferno, and the inferno is what caused the buildings to collapse.
And even given that, the design of the Twin Towers was such that they were able to stand up to an hour of baking in a 1,400-degree kerosene-fueled inferno, long enough to allow a lot of people to get out of the buildings, and a lot of effort and a lot of kudos need to be given to the engineers who overbuilt that structure. And the kinds of overbuilding of structure you see with nuclear power plants and with dry storage and spent fuel storage facilities in the United States is many, many times higher.
Here's a comment that is kind of pertinent to this discussion, and it's something to think about for folks. In a reaction to the questions about the security at power plants and stuff, Mr. Christopher Kane, who's a president and chief nuclear officer of Exelon Generation Company, said this: "We are not an industry overly driven by profits, and we have not pushed back very hard." He emphasized the industry will continue to spend the needed resources to protect its nuclear plants. Show me one other sector that's put anywhere near that money into it. You know, the expense of nuclear power is often not driven by technology, but simply by the willingness of the industry to do all it can to try to silence or to try to respond to its critics. The fact of the matter is, sometimes I want to counsel the leaders of the industry and say, sir, no matter what you do, you're not going to satisfy some of the people who simply want to shut you down.
Far better use of effort to prove to the people who are on the fence and the people who are in favor of the technology and get that simple majority that Lucy so wanted.
Yep.
You're never going to be able to please all the people all the time.
I'm going to shift gears to a topic that I just want to mention in passing, because it is being talked about all over the internet and through most major newscasts, and that is that today Iran announced that they have in fact successfully enriched uranium to a level of 3.5%, which is sufficient to provide the basis for commercial nuclear fuel. It's a small setup that they have, about 164 centrifuges, and that was the result of, the end result of that was a kind of a bragging announcement by the head of the state that announced that Iran has joined the nuclear technology club. Of course, course, the Great Britain and the U.S. are not particularly happy about that. But Iran does have its share of scientists and engineers, many of whom were educated in the U.S., Europe, Russia over the past 25 or 30 years, and it does have plenty of resources. It also has a long history as an energy producer, so it is pretty logical for them to be interested in a new energy source. And I won't make any judgments about the rest of their program.
Interesting.
So maybe they'll be able to enrich some silicon sometime in the near future, too.
We'll certainly be in market for that. So did you do any more reading on that link after the initial couple comments or just getting familiar with the technology?
Which one are we talking about here now?
It's the Isocon or the company that's actually doing the research for enriching silicon.
The silicon. Yeah, I did do some reading. It's pretty fascinating how purifying that silicon and even the impurity being simply a different isotope really makes the electricity flow more nicely, more uniformly through the material and reduces the heat production. And as you said, I think that that's going to be important as we try to get smaller and smaller transistors in our microprocessors.
Absolutely.
So there have been a couple of editorials this week, one from the Miami Herald, which has stated their official position as being quite in favor of Florida Power and Light's recent decision to investigate a new nuclear plant. As the Herald says, for the state of Florida, it says, considering today's fast-rising price of oil, coal, and natural gas, increasing nuclear output makes sense. FPL's customers would be appreciative, too, because cheaper nuclear energy could ease the pain of paying fuel surcharges on the monthly electric bill. And it also brings up in this editorial something that many people don't seem to want to recognize, people who say that the only thing we need to do is to use energy more efficiently. And in Florida, for example, Florida's fast-growing demand for energy, driven by a never-ending influx of people into a state where the population has doubled to more than 16 million people in the last 20 years.
Wow, I didn't know it was that high. I knew it was over 10 million, but I didn't think it was edging towards 20.
Yes, it is the third largest state. Not right, fourth. I guess it's behind
California, New York, and
Texas.
So
there are times when even if all those people reduce their energy use by a factor of two, a doubling of the population would simply keep them even.
Yep.
And the fact of the matter is, I can't imagine that them reducing their electricity consumption by a factor of two in today's environment.
Air conditioners are about as efficient as we can make them. They fundamentally, just because of thermodynamics, you're bailing out a sinking rowboat when you're air conditioning your house, because all that heat you dump outside is going to try to want to find its way back in. And there's no way that we can make that process any more than so many percent efficient. And we're pretty close to that limit.
Yep, and people like my grandmother who could live in South Florida without air conditioning are becoming further and further or more and more difficult to find.
Having stayed overnight in an Antebellum House mansion, or a fairly large house that was built just after the Civil War in Mississippi, I can definitely resonate with that. I mean, it's difficult to sleep for someone who's used to air conditioning, to sleep in a house where it cools down to 85 in the house at night.
Yeah, 85 with 85 to 90% humidity.
Yeah, I'll kick the heat index up there a little bit.
Yep.
So what do you think of the Farfus announcement in Ireland that they are considering nuclear plants?
I actually like it a lot because I'm a big proponent of powering island nations with nuclear power. Of course, in order to make nuclear power fit onto the electric grid of an island nation, you need something besides the standard 1,000 megawatt power plant.
It's interesting that they automatically think of nuclear power plants coming in these incredibly large packages, which cannot possibly be scaled down. Scaling them down doesn't even enter into the equation. You know, there was no mention of the study by Toshiba of Galena, Alaska, and the small nuclear plants that they're considering putting in there, although the cost of fuel there definitely justifies any fairly high expense of putting the facility in.
Well, Ireland does burn a lot of oil to produce electricity.
It's the third highest per capita consumer of energy in the European Union, according to the reports that I was reading.
Yep. And that's both for road transport, but also for electricity. When you're on an island, it's just easier to get oil to you than it is to get natural gas. And they don't have any installed coal, although they do have one coal plant that burns imported coal.
And, of course, the Irish have been digging peat for centuries, but peat is not renowned for its clean-burning properties.
Or its energy density is not particularly good either.
Seeing how the Irish have come through what seemed like centuries of going from bad to worse and come out into the 21st century as being one of the fastest growing economies in Europe and indeed in the world in terms of the fact that their unemployment rate is as low as it's ever been. It's never been lower. And the future in Ireland is bright. And I wish them well because I have living relatives in Ireland, according to one of my aunts who happens to be a big genealogy fan. We actually had some relatives who came over from Ireland and only in my great-grandparents' time. They were the first immigrants from the Collins family to come over on my mom's side.
How about that? I visited Ireland this summer. It's a beautiful little place, and one of the things that makes me think that Ireland is going to take a serious look at nuclear power is that their other option besides using nuclear would be something like building a transmission line from Great Britain over to Ireland. And there's a couple of problems with that.
Number one, Northern Ireland.
I was going to say one problem is the Irish certainly don't want to be dependent on the British.
Yeah, they've been working to get free of that for something on the order of 5 or 6 centuries.
And, of course, the other problem is that Great Britain, England in particular, is not going to have very much reserve capacity as its natural gas supplies from the North Sea begin to dwindle quite rapidly in the next few years. Very soon, the British government is supposed to release a report evaluating their energy options for the future, and it's lots of indications show that it's going to include a fairly strong statement about the possibility for new nuclear power plants in Britain, although there's plenty of opposition lining up against that possibility.
You can oppose all you want, but the fundamental fact of the matter is it's going to get dark and it's going to get cold.
Well, I think that people who are...
Slowly enough to allow a transition while people are still open, or some of the people, some of the time, are open to doing it.
Well, I believe that the people who are in favor of nuclear power plants, who have done the research or at least open-minded, need to realize that there are people who are not open-minded. They have established themselves. They have established a career as being against nuclear power. And That's okay. It's fine for people to oppose. We can't let the minority of people make the decisions for the rest of us, particularly when their decisions are flat out wrong. Can I say that clear enough?
I don't think we could have cut it any clearer than that, in spite of, well, at least I've had a little training in how to convey ideas to a non-technical audience, and having grown up a geek in a non-technical family, I learned early that opening my mouth and equations flying out was not going to get me listened to.
Well, I try to use the half of my brain that was produced by the English teacher mother, and sometimes use the other half of my brain that was produced by the electrical engineer father, and see if I can't communicate just a little bit more clearly than the average engineer. And quite honestly, there are times when I simply look around and say, well, in the land of the blind, a one-eyed man is king.
You can't argue with that.
So I'm not saying I'm a great communicator, but at least I can try.
And compared with people who spent their entire college careers learning how to subtly craft sentences so as to backspin three or four implied, almost subliminal meanings just by careful choosing the phrases, it's a little discouraging sometimes, but I think people are starting to realize that the engineers and the scientists who've been saying since day one, and this is something that's mentioned in several books, sure, there's a split in the scientific community over nuclear power. What they don't tell you is that the split is something like 98-2.
Well, there are plenty of technologists who are not particularly in favor of nuclear power. But their reasons are interesting or varied. I remember reading a book by some astronauts. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I've got it somewhere on my bookshelf.
I may very well have a copy of that. I have an entire wall of space books in one of my bookcases.
But this book basically
was the title of the book Return to the Moon by any chance?
Could be. The main premise, and these are astronauts are very technical people, but the main premise was that the U.S. Science budget had been focused way too much on nuclear stuff. So they were opposed to nuclear just because it was taking away resources from space. And, of course,
well, that NASA's politicking and the kinds of pie slicing that's been going on there is a subject of entirely separate podcast, and I could start going to that, but suffice to say there's a lot more to the story, folks.
Well,
and that's a very, very narrow-minded, zero-sum game type of attitude.
Well, let's think about that for another podcast, but it is getting close to 40 minutes for this one, and I have a responsibility coming up here shortly, so I'm going to want to kind of wind this one down. I think we covered the security aspects of the power plants pretty well. A couple of new projects. Anything else that we need to say tonight before we sign off?
Go green, go atomic.
I like
haven't said it any better myself.
I like that. Hey, Shane, have a great week, and don't let the programming stuff get you down, man.
Well, all you have to do is remember that if we built buildings the way we build computer programs, the first woodpecker to come along would destroy civilization.
Yeah, that reminds me of that old story where Bill Gates was talking to a bunch of automotive folks, and he said, if you guys had improved the mileage on cars as fast as we'd improved computing capacity, you could go across the country on a teaspoon of gas. And, of course, the automotive guy said, well, but, Bill, we can't afford a couple of blue screens every couple of miles.
This is true.
All right. Take care.
I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, this is Patrick O'Keefe, host of the Community Admin Show on the Podcast Network. My show is the biweekly podcast for online community managers and administrators. We talk about community management, promotion, monetization, and more. If you run an online community, check it out at communityadmin.thepodcastnetwork.com.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.